Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. You know, WGN Radio has a long storied history, celebrating 90 years this June. But there were milestones that led up to the very beginnings of WGN. In the early 1920s, the Chicago Tribune's publisher, Colonel Robert McCormick, wrote a letter to his mother and stated, "You cannot help being thrilled at the little box that picks up sound from the air." And back in 1921, Colonel McCormick jumped into the new medium of radio and had agreed to supply Chicago Tribune news and market reports for Westinghouse Electric's KWY, Chicago's first radio station. Thousands of listeners in a 500-mile radius from Chicago tuned in nightly to music and news programming broadcast from the top of the Commonwealth Edison Building. It was in 1922 that a new experimental radio station in Chicago was launched that eventually became WGN Radio in 1924. And to take us through the early years as we approach a milestone, both today and on March 29th, is broadcaster historian Chuck Shaden, who was the producer and host of the long-running Those Were the Days radio program. He has been nationally recognized for his efforts and was inducted to the Radio Hall of Fame in 1993. A former newspaper editor and marketing executive, he turned his hobby into a vocation and drew from a collection of more than 50,000 vintage radio programs to prepare his broadcast. He was the founding editor and publisher of Nostalgia Digest. He is the author of Speaking of Radio, Chuck Shaden's Conversations with the Stars of the Golden Age of Radio. And he has interviewed hundreds of performers, writers, producers, and directors, all associated with the golden days of radio. And now, Chuck's interviews can be heard on his website, speakingofradio.com. And tonight he joins us to walk us through the early days of WGN Radio. Hey there, Chuck.
Thank you. It's going to be a tiptoe through the tulips, right, for us?
It certainly is, Chuck.
Early days of WGN Radio.
Yeah.
You know, Dave, this is not the first time I've been on WGN talking about their origins.
Well, tell me when you did it before. Back in 1924?
No, not in 1924. In June of 1984,
okay,
when WGN was 65 years old, they asked me to produce and host a program on WGN about the anniversary of the station. It was on for 2 hours on the 30th of June.
How cool was that?
So, and I don't have a copy of that. I wish I did.
Oh, man, that would have been, talking about a tiptoe through the tulips, that would have been a great look back. I could have just played that then, Chuck, for the next 2 hours.
That's a lot of water over the tulips.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, I'm delighted to be here with you tonight.
Well, thanks for being here. You know, this is the milestone that I was referring to, Chuck. So One evening in early 1924, Colonel McCormick and his mother were given a special radio demonstration, and it really excited him. And while the Tribune, you know, could have applied, like others, for their own license, the Colonel wanted to lease time, kind of dipping his toe into radio, then owning it. And that's kind of what we're doing, actually, with the game on 87.7 right now, as we're leasing it. But on March 23rd, 1924, which is today, he entered into an agreement to rent time and facilities from WJAZ. And in addition to the news, the Tribune provided musical programming and other things as well. And the station was actually launched this week on March 29th. It wasn't ours. We were still leasing, but it was March 29th.
And they used the WGN call letters.
Yes, for the first time.
And now, then a little later after that, there was another station in town called WDAP.
Okay.
And it had been owned by the Drake Hotel, or it was at the Drake Hotel. And then they moved over, WGN moved over to the top of the Drake, and they were using for a little while the WDAP call letters. Then they changed them to WGN, and there they had studios atop the Drake Hotel until it moved to the Tribune Tower quite a few years later in 1935.
Wow. And, you know, what's amazing here is that, you know, you talked about WDAP. Now, these were some young Chicago guys. They were radio enthusiasts. And it was Thorne Donnelly and Elliot Jenkins from Midwest Radio Central that started this experimental station that was DAP at one time. And it started broadcasting from the Wrigley Building right across the street, of course, from the Tribune Tower. And, you know, again, there was only those two guys, a couple of other programming guys, and, you know, there would be live dance music, but they also did some programming in the Drake Hotel as well.
Well, yeah, they occupied, get a load of this, two handball courts near the top of the Drake Hotel.
Really?
Yeah.
That's where the
and
stations
the reason
went.
They moved from the Wrigley Building because a tornado went through town and damaged the antenna atop the Wrigley Building.
Wow.
Right up, the antenna was up near the, you know, in the tower by the clock on top of the Wrigley Building.
You know, I've seen pictures of WDAP and that first radio station, and I noticed that the ceilings were very high, and I thought it looked more like you would do something in a television studio. Of course, television wasn't around back then with lighting and so forth, but I thought, boy, they're very narrow and very tall. So they were...
Well, yeah, go ahead.
No, so they were, handball courts.
Well... Yeah, that's they weren't going to lower the ceiling for this stuff, but they had to drape everything with heavy fabrics like drapes and all of that to deaden the sound. You know, those early radio studios looked a lot like what you would see in a living room of a very well-off family in the early 1920s. And they would have plush, thick carpeting all around. They had drapes on the wall, and then here for the radio studio, they even had heavy draperies hanging from the ceiling or covering the ceiling.
Okay.
And you would almost think it was a living room because if you look closely, you could see the microphone or two.
Yeah, right.
But otherwise, no, there were some easy chairs in there, and a couple of desks, and always a grand piano in the studio. And it was very comfortable, but no windows. There were never any windows in these early studios because that, of course, would break the sound barrier, so to speak.
Right. They didn't have the silencing windows and layers that we have today. But then it was 1923. So again, we're leading up to when WGN was really launched. Board of Trade purchased WDAP, and then they started. But it was also, back then, it was really a lot of music and maybe some news. There wasn't even sports back then. It was a lot of music, right? I mean, that's really what kind of launched radio.
Oh, yeah. And much of it was not recorded, but it was live music. And they in those days, those stations, as much as they were going along, like WGN, working on a shoestring kind of a budget and not really hoping to get much revenue from such nasty things as sponsors, as they used to think about. So they thought that they would they wanted to do the best they could for programming, so then they had an orchestra. It might have been a 6-piece orchestra or a 12-piece orchestra, and they broke up members of the orchestra into little ensembles, and they would be performing at different times of the day. And in the early days, no wire services were going into WGN, but the Tribune was providing stories, news stories, and stock reports, and a few other things. Sometimes you get little brief news reports. They would call them headlines today, but basically that's what they were doing, all for that little box that picks up sounds from the air.
Yeah, right. Well, you were talking about a shoestring budget. I think we're still on a shoestring budget. Over here.
Yeah.
That's
well,
a radio business
radio
I've learned.
Today. Yes,
that's
right
exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. So, you know, he was leasing WJAZ. Now, this was a station that was launched by Zenith in 1923 at the Edgewater Beach Hotel.
Right. Which later took on call letters of WEBH, which, of course, stood for the Edgewater Beach Hotel.
Okay.
And, by the way, you might as well mention that WGN stood for what Colonel McCormick called the Chicago Tribune, the world's greatest newspaper.
Right, exactly.
WGN.
And
they wouldn't call it the world's greatest station because they didn't have any background on that yet, but it was always the world's greatest newspaper, yeah.
Now, what's funny is in 1924, as really we were approaching the launch the station, that there were, the Chicago Tribune stated that there was more than 100,000 radio sets in the Chicago area, and I would think that's a lot for back then because that was an expensive piece to have in your home.
Well, you might think it is an awful lot of sets in the Chicago area, but I'll tell you, this was the biggest thing ever. This was the greatest thing since vaudeville and phonograph records to have as Colonel told his mother, a little box in your home to bring you this entertainment into it. And interestingly enough, most of those sets were pretty easily priced.
Okay.
And you would buy a radio receiver, but you didn't necessarily get the tubes with it, and you didn't necessarily get the speaker with it. So we were buying components. I wasn't, but somebody was buying.
I get what you're saying.
Buying the component parts. So if you wanted to, you bought your radio receiver from Marshall Field and Company. Then if you wanted to, you could go to your local, there's a local radio store, and you would buy the tubes for that radio. And then you, of course, had to have some kind of a speaker, and there were many stores that were selling speakers. And you could buy a speaker that would be compatible with the decor you had in your home. So you had you might have bought a big console radio, or you might have had a table radio, but you could get a speaker of any size or any quality to put along with that. So, and you'd plug it in.
So you were essentially building your own radio. I mean, that's what you're doing,
so to speak. You weren't manufacturing it, but you were buying the parts for it.
Yeah.
And think about people who did that at the very beginning of the radio days, and years later when they got one of these now very clumsy transistor radios.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so, no kidding, right?
And it had everything right there with it, you know.
Yeah.
So it was quite a thing, and everybody had the radio, and nobody went out. Radio is one of the things that killed vaudeville.
Right.
But vaudeville, on the other hand, went on to supply radio with a lot of its stars.
For 30 years.
Performers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right up into TV.
Yeah, it was, absolutely.
And so everybody had a radio, and many people had crystal sets, or many people had radios without speakers, but they were using earphones. My father used to tell me about many families had a big punch bowl, a glass punch bowl, and they put the punch bowl in the center of the dining room table, and then they had the radio over there someplace, a little table model type radio, and you had the earphones, and you'd plug them into the radio, and you'd lay the earphones at the bottom of the punch bowl. And the punch bowl acted as an amplifier and a speaker so that several people could sit around and listen
to the radio. That's brilliant.
Instead of one person at a time with the headset on. Because if you only had one headset, you'd say, well, you can listen for a half an hour. No, I'm going to listen. And then the next guy's going to listen. And the third guy's going to listen.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing you say that is now, you know, now that we have iPhones and smartphones, the way I will play something, if I'm playing it, I want somebody to hear something, hear a message, or hear something that I found. I will cup my hand, kind of, you know, and everybody does this. They cup their hand on the bottom of the phone so that it amplifies off your hand a little bit. So it's very funny.
Same story.
Now, what's cool is that when we launched this on March 29th, you know, again, assuming control of WJAZ, we weren't on 720. 720 didn't come till later. We were on
shared a frequency with WMAQ, I think.
Yeah, so they were on 670, and then we eventually moved to 810 AM.
Right.
And again, it was all kinds of music, and the schedule at that time included a 5-hour broadcast to be heard almost 10,000 miles across the Pacific.
Well, that's the skip, you know.
Yeah, that's the skip. I know, that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, Well, we'll get to the heyday a little later, but it was very big, all of this stuff. And WGN really was a leader in Chicago radio because they didn't depend just on programming coming out of the studio. They did a lot of remote broadcasts, and I'm talking a little bit about the band remotes and things that they had, but I'm talking about special event things like in Memorial Day of 1924, they covered the Indy 500.
Yeah, isn't that something?
It wasn't known as the Indy 500 at that time, but the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, you know. But listeners heard that, and they also heard there was an announcer by the name of A.W. Caney, and he called the race so that people could find out what's going on. And he did this station identification. He said, this is WDAP, soon to be WGN, located on the Drake Hotel, Chicago.
That's cool. So that was because really it was the next day. It was the next day that, June 1st, that
That's right.
we
well,
really
it, it
launched.
Say, but soon to be heard, it was the next day, June the 1st, yeah. Then on June the 1st, they said, this is WGN, formerly WDAP.
And that was Elliot Jenkins, who I believe was one of
the... That was the announcer.
Yeah,
that
was the announcer. Wow. And then it goes from there. I mean, I'm looking at some of the, you know, in October 1st of 1924, which I think is just a milestone, is Sen Caney, who you were talking about, he broadcast the first baseball game, a City Series matchup between the Cubs and the White Sox. So it was October 1st, 1924, that we first started airing the Chicago Cubs on the station.
David, could that have been a Subway Series?
That could, it could have been.
Did we have that?
I guess so. No, I guess so.
I'm not sure. I know more radio than they do Chicago. But I don't know when the Subway came in there, but it was like, you know, the crosstown stuff. So that was pretty good. But that was just a one-shot thing. It was a City Series, and they did that broadcasting thing. And then they had a football game from Memorial Stadium in Champaign, and that's a game where Illinois beat Michigan, and Quinn Ryan was behind the microphone. Quinn Ryan, a legendary WGN broadcaster. He's been deified over the years, and he's really synonymous with WGN in those early days. He told listeners about the four touchdowns that Red Grange scored in the first 12 minutes of that.
That's awesome.
Can you believe that?
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. Well, I'll tell you what, there's so much more milestones to talk about really in the early days. And right now we're talking to radio historian and Radio Hall of Famer Chuck Shaden about the early days of WGN Radio. And there's much more ahead on 720 WGN. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to Chuck Shaden, my friend, radio historian, and Radio Hall of Famer, about the early days of WGN Radio. So now we've kind of passed through really how WGN was put together. And then in 1925, New Year's, and I know this because, you know, Orion Samuelson does the Tournament of Roses parade for various TV stations and radio stations across the country. But we aired it for the first time on January 1st of 1925.
Yeah, and that was Quinn Ryan again. But Quinn was not in Pasadena for that game.
Okay.
Quinn was in the WGN studio in the Drake Hotel, and he was getting ticker tape coverage. And he used it like Ronald Reagan broadcast other baseball games years later. And many announcers used to do this, but this was really something. He's broadcasting the Tournament of Roses parade. Now, all you're doing is you're going to be describing every one of those floats and all of that stuff, right?
Right, right.
And so here he is reading it from the ticker tape.
Wow.
And they had in the studio a brass band and some alumni from Notre Dame, as they were in the game. And they had cheerleaders in the studio adding to the atmosphere. So there was sound effects and ambience. But he was really reading it from the ticker tape. Now, in other occasions, I've heard from broadcasters who were doing baseball reenactments of this, and it was not uncommon because they weren't going to the game, and they would be reading it off the ticker.
Wow.
And the ticker would just have abbreviated stuff, strike one, strike two, so forth and so on. But every once in a while, the ticker tape would break, or there would be a breakdown in the feed. And these guys had a vamp.
I guess so.
So he says, swing and a miss, foul ball. You know, that's 16 foul balls while they were repairing the ticker tape. But they did it in order, and he was doing the Tournament of Roses game using the reports, and they beat Notre Dame beat Stanford 27-10.
And then later that spring, it just puts you in perspective of what time in our history this was. But they were hosting a prohibition debate, WGN, with 47,000 listeners. They voted 3-1 against prohibition. But I mean, you think about how important though this station is. Not only to Chicago, but to America, just from an informational standpoint. And we were part of the prohibition debate in 1925.
Well, people used to have to wait for the newspaper to come out to get any kind of information or to read about a debate. But now with radio on the scene, they could hear about it right on the spot, and they could hear things. You know, the Tribune would have to come out with an extra edition for some special event that was going on or some news, breaking news. But with radio, bang, it was right there.
Yeah.
And, of course, this was a little bone of contention between radio and newspapers in the beginning, because the radio was trying to get some stuff, some information from the newspapers, and the newspapers didn't want them to have that. And initially the newspapers, not the Tribune, because the Tribune was at WGN right away. But many newspapers refused to publish the radio listings, because they didn't want the readers to go to radio for information. They wanted to go to newspapers. But eventually they came together, and they all realized the value of radio to newspapers and the value of newspapers to radio.
Especially this organization here.
That's right. Absolutely. That's right. And it kind of changed now soon, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's going to be changing toward the end of the year, end of the summer. It's going to split. But I'm sure there's still going to be some strategic alliances between the groups, of course. So later in April 14th, there was the first Cubs game, the regular season Cubs game. But then in the summertime, there was the Scopes Monkey Trial, which is a really famous trial that WGN provided coverage for. Share with us a little information about that.
Well, they took the microphone. Quinn Ryan, again, reporting, he took an engineer by the name of Paul Neal. They took it down to Dayton, Tennessee, where this trial was going to be. And this was William Jennings Bryant and Clarence Darrow, involved in a trial of a high school teacher by the name of John Scopes. He was indicted for teaching evolution in high school.
Right, right.
And Brian argued for the prosecution and Darrow for the defense. Now, you want to know how much influence radio had on that particular trial?
Yeah, tell me.
When the WGN microphone arrived, they placed it in the center of the courtroom, and they rearranged the seating in the courtroom around the WGN microphone.
Wow.
So that everybody could listen to this thing. Everybody could speak into the thing. So you had William Jennings Bryan, you had Clarence Darrow, and you had the sound of the judge and all of this sort of thing. And sometimes there was they had to send the jury out of the courtroom because there was something they wanted to discuss. They sent the jury, outside of the courthouse on the grounds, where speakers were set up so that the public could listen to the trial being broadcast. So the jury is out on the grounds around the courthouse,
wow,
listening to the radio, and the radio is broadcasting what's going on inside the courthouse.
Wow.
So it was an amazing thing.
Absolutely.
And this, of course, this whole idea of WGN and broadcasting this so-called monkey trial from Tennessee was depicted in the movie Inherit the Wind with Spencer Tracy as a character based on Darrow and Frederick March as a character based on Brian.
This was an expensive thing for WGN, too. It was costing, I think, like a grand a day.
Oh, yeah. And it went on from the 13th of July till the 21st of August.
But it really put them on the map, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It really put them on the map.
So WGN really was responsible for so many what we would call today actualities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And many actualities today are 40 seconds. But this was, all these days. Amazing.
Well, then here we go. Then later in the fall, the Chicago Tribune purchased two Elgin radio stations to expand their coverage areas. So this is as we start climbing to our 50,000 watts eventually.
Yeah, right.
But for a time, WGN and WLIB, which was Tribune's national magazine Liberty, shared the 980 frequency and went back and forth. So, again, I don't think we're still on 720 here. And then, in the fall, then we had a Christmas Carol was performed on the radio, which we, by the way, we just did this last Christmas, too. So this tradition continues here at WGN.
By the way, I'll mention an aside on this Christmas Carol broadcast in December of 1925. It was performed by a person by the name of Bill Hay. Now, Bill Hay was an announcer on WGN. And later, when Amos and Andy emerged, Bill Hay was the announcer for that show, and he opened the program every night with, "Here they are, Amos and Andy."
Very good.
And so there he is, going way back to December of 25, sometime before Amos and Andy made an appearance.
Well, yeah, and I know that Amos and Andy, which I want to tell this story too, is something that started on WGN with a different name. Actually, it was this past week, that they celebrated also an anniversary. But tell the story about Sam and Henry into Amos and Andy.
Well, there were two vaudeville-type performers on WGN, singing mostly, by the name of Freeman Gosden and Charles Correll. And they would they were on here, and they were there on the schedule another place, and they would do these little things. And so they finally gave him an anchor spot on the air. And frankly, it was Colonel McCormick who suggested to the program director of WGN, who suggested to Gosden and Correll, that they do a little sketch on their program based on a very popular Tribune comic strip called The Gumps. Now, Gosden and Correll read The Gumps, as many, many, many people did, but they couldn't figure out how they could bring these two characters, Andy Gump and his wife and all that stuff, to radio. So they kind of dismissed that idea, but eventually they developed a character, two characters called Sam and Henry, started early in 26. It was set in an African-American community, but the main characters were voiced by these two guys who were Caucasian.
Right.
Anyway, Sam and Henry was very popular, very, very popular. And so...
But it was one of the first sitcoms. It was is actually, if not the first... WGN.
Well,
has...
I guess you could call it a sitcom. You know,
right.
It's two guys doing stuff on radio.
Yeah.
Bob and Ray did it too. You know,
yeah.
Years later, and I don't think we called Bob and Ray a sitcom, but
true.
Nevertheless,
all right, fair enough.
We had Sam and Henry, so they were doing a good job, and they wanted to expand. They wanted to do more than when they were being heard on WGN, and they tried to do some things with recordings that they could. They called it bicycling from radio station to radio station, kind of forming a little syndicated program to go out there. And that was a little bit difficult, but they had heard that another station in town was soon going to join the Columbia Broadcasting System. And they went over there, and they decided that they would join this other station because that they would be on a network, because WGN was an independent station,
heard
in a large Midwest area,
but not
on any kind of a network.
Yeah, not associated with anybody yet.
Right. So Gosden and Correll went up to the top of the Drake Hotel to talk to the boss at WGN, and they said that they had this opportunity to go, and they would like to take it and be relieved of the contract. Well, their contract that they had was really kind of a handshake and didn't hold any real water. So the manager said, well, if you guys want to do this, you can do it. It's probably a pretty good break for you. We understand that. First time management ever understood that, right?
yeah, exactly.
And that's another milestone.
Hello.
And they said, oh, but by the way, you can't take with you the names Sam and Henry, because by this time, Sam and Henry had become a one-panel comic strip in the Tribune.
Ah, got it.
So now that was copywritten and all that stuff. So they said, well, okay, we'll change. We'll do something. We won't take the names with. So they left the manager's office at the top of the Drake. They get into an elevator, and they're starting to go down. And they're thinking, well, what could we call this? And they realized that the elevator operator was somebody that they hadn't seen many times. Those were the days before automatic elevators. They had elevator operators in there. And they knew this fellow's name happened to be Amos. Didn't register. Elevator descends to the main lobby of the Drake Hotel. The door opens, and there's someone mopping up the lobby. Of the elevator lobby, and they knew him too because they'd seen him many times as they broadcast their programming from there. And his name was Andy. And Freeman Gosden looked at Charles Correll, and they both at the same time just about said, "Amos and Andy." And Amos and Andy they became, and they took the job, and they went up there, and they became radio's all-time favorites.
Well, and they did this for 30 years, and of course they went into television. But, I mean, it had its controversies really at the end of the 50s and in the 60s and got pulled out of syndication at one point as well.
Oh, yeah, but when they came on, when they started all of this stuff, blackface on radio was a common thing.
Yeah.
It was all over the place. So they were extraordinarily popular because of how they did it.
Yeah.
And they had people from all over every walk of life listening into their program. He has Sam and Henry, and later as Amos and Andy, but started in Chicago at WGN.
Well, I want to talk about the importance also of music on our station, and then our relationship with a huge broadcasting network, which was the Mutual Broadcasting Company, and all the shows that came out of there. And we're talking to radio historian and Radio Hall of Famer Chuck Shane about the early days of WGN Radio. Much more ahead on 720 WGN. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking about the early days of WGN Radio with my friend and radio historian and Radio Hall of Famer, Chuck Shaden. So we were just talking a little bit about, the beginning, the early days, and some of the first programs that were on. But then, you know, we started expanding a little bit more, and there was our first commercial program debuted. It was called the Radio Floorwalker in 1928. What was that all about?
Well, that was a variety program, really. It just had, however, the thing that was made it different was that it had commercials interspersed throughout the program, and listeners were complaining about that. So listeners figured, I paid for the radio, why do I have to pay for the programming? But I'm not even paying for the programming, but I have to listen to it.
Yeah, right.
So they were hearing the commercials, but they were starting to people were starting to respond to those commercials, and they were very. Very subtle commercials that was going on at that time, but the Tribune, did not consider radio a commercial enterprise. So they had losses nearly $1 million over the first 15 years the station was on the air.
Wow!
But they persisted, and if they had only had Wally Phillips back in those days, it would have been
gangbusters. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it was right around that.
That was a nice variety program that they had, and that was music. That was live music. And there was a lot of live music on the air, but they were also, as they did with the remote broadcasts for the special events, they had a lot of remote broadcasts coming from music venues and hotels and nightclubs and places like that all around the city of Chicago. In fact, in some time later, WGN was known as the best station in the nation as far as bands were concerned. And all the bands really owed a great deal of success to WGN and other stations that were carrying those basically sustaining, meaning non-commercial, band remotes from one venue or another. I mean, the Aragon, the Trina, the Edgewater Beach Hotel, downtown hotels like the Palmer House and the Bismarck Hotel, and the Blackhawk Restaurant. And Wabash and Randolph, that's where the Coon-Sanders Nighthawks were broadcasting on a regular basis. And those bands all recognized the fact that people would hear them on the radio, usually the late evening. And then when the band came to their town, they would be recognizable, and people would come out to go see the bands and hear them and dance in person. And that really made it for the big bands. The little bands, the big bands, the local bands, all of the bands were so big because of radio, and WGN had really a terrific signal, and they got all over the place. So they were able to really promote the big band music.
Well, the Blackhawk Restaurant, I mean, that was a very, very popular place for all these bands. And there's tons of content still out there that I think you can still get, like, through the audio file of a lot of these performances.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was radio was very big with music, and it really didn't come until much later in the earliest years where they were starting to play recordings. Some of the programs were playing recordings, but, people had records at home.
Mm-hmm.
They had the old wind-up Victrolas.
Sure.
And they opened the two doors in the front, you know, and
yeah.
Wind it up on the side and put the needle on it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then we finally
lovely.
Go into the music.
Well, what's cool, too, is around this time, Chuck, is that that's when we finally moved, right at the end of 1927, early 1928, that's when we moved to 720. Obviously where we've been ever since. But then there's, we were the first station in 1928, first independent station to broadcast coverage from the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. We were doing police bulletins to those officers and their squad cars. But then it was 1930, October 11th, that the Tribune – increased its signal strength to our 50,000 watts that we know today.
That's right, and I believe from that point on it was a clear channel, too, so mm-hmm. meaning no other station in the country could broadcast at 720.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
On the dial. So that was good. You know what kind of a signal that WGN had from Chicago? They could be heard as far north as Minnesota, as far south to central Texas, as far east to western Pennsylvania, and as far west to Utah.
See, now that's amazing. I was actually traveling, I don't know, it was about a year and a half ago when I was in Houston, and it was about 5 o'clock in the morning, so it was still pretty early when I was heading to the airport. And it was faint, and it was a little scratchy, but I could still get, and I think Johnny was on at the time, but I could still get the signal of GN down there, and that absolutely amazed me. I was listening to Blackhawks games when I was in Columbus for a meeting, and I could listen in my rental car while I was driving around. So it's amazing the power of this station. And then, you know, I know in the 1930s, early 1930s, 33, we had some brief associations with NBC and with CBS, but it really wasn't until 1934 that we associated ourselves with a larger broadcasting company.
That's right. There was a group of stations that got together to form I guess you would call it a network, although it wasn't initially called a mutual broadcasting system, but it became that. And that started in 1934, a very good year, I might add.
Okay, got the hint. All right.
And they combined forces, WGN combined forces with WOR in Newark, New Jersey, which, of course, served the whole eastern seaboard there. Then with WLW in Cincinnati, which had a tremendous signal. In fact, WLW had something like 100,000 watts.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that was possible.
They got shot down on that after a while, but they were 100,000 watts. They were broadcasting in New Mexico, you know.
Wow. And that's a Crosley Radio Company that owned that station, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So you had WGN, WOR, WLW, and then they had WXYZ in Detroit.
Okay. All right.
So now each of these stations were contributing something to network programming, because they could provide whatever programming they want, and most of the stations were providing programming that didn't have network commercials in it.
Okay.
They were not nationally sponsored yet. So WGN was doing Lum and Abner, and locally Lum and Abner might have been sponsored by a malted milk company.
Okay.
But later,
more national.
More national, okay. And then you can answer this question for sure. What program was the biggest program on the mutual system that came out of Detroit?
I have to say, it's the Lone Ranger.
You're right, on WXYZ in Detroit. Yep. That's right. So we had, and that started about 1933. Well, it started in 1933 in Detroit, but then it went on the mutual broadcasting system. So it was really a big thing, and over all the years, the mutual broadcasting system was a network of stations they did not own.
Right. But they contributed.
They owned their own station, but they contributed to it. And it wasn't until many years later in the 1980s that the mutual broadcasting system actually purchased a station, like an owned and operated station. And that was WCFL in Chicago, which is no longer around.
Right,
there's different call letters and all that sort of thing now.
Sure.
So they had all of that. So it was very interesting. They made a big Horlicks malted milk is what I'm trying to think.
Okay,
of.
All yeah, right. For Lum and Abner. Yeah.
Right.
And then there was the Witch's Tale, which was really the first. You know, we've talked about this before around Halloween about suspense and some of these great. But the Witch's Tale was really one of the first like scary edge of your seat type of programs that were on the radio. And then really at the end of this, in October of 35, WGN dedicated its new home where we are now, a four-story building built in as an addition to the Tribune Tower. The 600, it's actually a little bit further over than we are now, but it's the 600, it was $600,000. It was built in the midst of the Great Depression, which is, you know, pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Six studios, master rooms, seven studio control centers, workshops, dressing rooms, offices, and a 450-seat studio theater so that when there was performances, you could have live performances and have crowds come in and,
right,
and watch it. But that was really, really the launch of where we are today, and those are the early days of WGN Radio. And Chuck, I would love it if you would come back and talk to us and take the next step into the 40s, 50s, early 60s, and we can walk through the rest of the history of the station.
I'll be happy to walk with you, David.
All right, sounds good, pal. Well, you can find Chuck Shaden, and again, thousands of amazing interviews from the golden age of radio at speakingofradio.com, and we'll put that in the podcast as well. Chuck, thanks so much. Enjoy your Sunday, pal.
Thank you very much, Dave.
All right, it's Dave Flyer on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.